4. Atonement with the Father.
The bow of God's wrath is bent, and the arrow made ready on the string. And justice bends the arrow at your heart and strains the bow. And it is nothing but the mere pleasure of God, and that of an angry God, without any promise or obligation at all, that keeps the arrow one moment from being made drunk with your blood.
With these words, Jonathan Edwards threatened the hearts of his New England congregation by disclosing to them, unmitigated, the ogre aspect of the Father. He riveted them to the pews with images of the mythological ordeal. For though the Puritan prohibited the graven image, yet he allowed himself the verbal. "The wrath," Jonathan Edwards thundered.
"The wrath of God is like great waters that are dammed for the present. They increase more and more, and rise higher and higher, till an outlet is given. And the longer the stream is stopped, the more rapid and mighty is its course when once it is let loose. 'Tis true, the judgment against your evil works has not been executed hitherto. The floods of God's vengeance have been withheld. But your guilt, in the meantime, is constantly increasing, and you are every day treasuring up more wrath. The waters are continually rising and waxing more and more mighty, and there is nothing but the mere pleasure of God that holds the waters back that are unwilling to be stopped and press hard to go forward. If God should only withdraw his hand from the floodgate, it would immediately fly open, and the fiery floods of the fierceness of the wrath of God would rush forth with inconceivable fury, and would come upon you with omnipotent power, and if your strength were 10,000 times greater than it is, yea, 10,000 times greater than the strength of the stoutest, sturdiest devil in hell, it would be nothing to withstand or endure it."
Having threatened with the element water, Pastor Jonathan next turns to the image of fire.
"The God that holds you over the pit of hell, much as one holds a spider or some loathsome insect over the fire, abhors you and is dreadfully provoked. His wrath towards you burns like fire. He looks upon you as worthy of nothing else but to be cast into the fire. He is of purer eyes than to bear to have you in his sight. You are 10,000 times so abominable in his eyes as the most hateful, venomous serpent is in ours. You have offended him infinitely more than ever a stubborn rebel did his prince, and yet 'tis nothing but his hand that holds you from falling into the fire every moment. Oh, sinner, you hang by a slender thread, with the flames of divine wrath flashing about it, and ready every moment to singe it and burn it asunder. And you have no interest in any mediator, and nothing to lay hold of to save yourself, nothing to keep off the flames of wrath, nothing of your own, nothing that you ever have done, nothing that you can do to induce God to spare you one moment."
But now, at last, the great resolving image of the second birth. Only for a moment, however.
"Thus are all you that never passed under a great change of heart, by the mighty power of the Spirit of God upon your souls. All that were never born again, and made new creatures, and raised from being dead in sin to a state of new and before altogether unexperienced light and life, however you may have reformed your life in many things, and may have had religious affections, and may keep up a form of religion in your families and closets, and in the house of God, and may be strict in it. You are thus in the hands of an angry God. 'Tis nothing but his mere pleasure that keeps you from being this moment swallowed up in everlasting destruction."
God's mere pleasure, which defends the sinner from the arrow, the flood, and the flames, is termed in the traditional vocabulary of Christianity God's mercy, and the mighty power of the Spirit of God, by which the heart is changed, that is God's grace. In most mythologies, the images of mercy and grace are rendered as vividly as those of justice and wrath, so that a balance is maintained and the heart is buoyed rather than scourged along its way. "Fear not," says the hand gesture of the god Shiva, as he dances before his devotee, the dance of the universal destruction. "Fear not, for all rests well in God, the forms that come and go, and of which your body is but one, are the flashes of my dancing limbs. Know me in all, and of what shall you be afraid?" The magic of the sacraments, made effective through the passion of Jesus Christ or by virtue of the meditations of the Buddha, the protective power of primitive amulets and charms, and the supernatural helpers of the myths and fairy tales of the world are mankind's assurances that the arrow, the flames, and the flood are not as brutal as they seem. For the ogre aspect of the father is a reflex of the victim's own ego, derived from the sensational nursery scene that has been left behind, but projected before. And the fixating idolatry of that pedagogical non-thing is itself the fault that keeps one steeped in a sense of sin, sealing the potentially adult spirit from a better balanced, more realistic view of the father, and therewith of the world. Atonement, at one meant, consists in no more than the abandonment of that self-generated double monster. The dragon, thought to be God, superego, or interego, and the dragon thought to be sin, repressed id. But this requires an abandonment of the attachment to ego itself, and that is what is difficult. One must have a faith that the Father is merciful, and then a reliance on that mercy. Therewith, the center of belief is transferred outside of the bedeviling God's tight, scaly ring, and the dreadful ogres dissolve. It is in this ordeal that the hero may derive hope and assurance from the helpful female figure, by whose magic, pollen charms, or power of intercession, he is protected through all the frightening experiences of the father's ego-shattering initiation. For if it is impossible to trust the terrifying father face, then one's faith must be centered elsewhere, Spider Woman, Blessed Mother, and with that reliance for support, one endures the crisis, only to find, in the end, that the father and mother reflect each other and are, in essence, the same. When the twin warriors of the Navajo, having departed from Spider Woman with her advice and protective charms, had made their perilous way between the rocks that crush, through the reeds that cut to pieces, and the cactus plants that tear to pieces, and then across the boiling sands, they came at last to the house of the sun, their father. The door was guarded by two bears. These arose and growled, but the words that Spider Woman had taught the boys made the animals crouch down again. After the bears, there threatened a pair of serpents, then winds, then lightnings, the guardians of the ultimate threshold. All were readily appeased, however, with the words of the prayer. Built of turquoise, the house of the sun was great and square, and it stood on the shore of a mighty water. The boys entered it, and they beheld a woman sitting in the west, two handsome young men in the south, two handsome young women in the north. The young women stood up without a word, wrapped the newcomers in four sky coverings, and placed them on a shelf. The boys lay quietly. Presently, a rattle hanging over the door shook four times, and one of the young women said, "Our father is coming." The bearer of the sun strode into his home, removed the sun from his back, and hung it on a peg on the west wall of the room, where it shook and clanged for some time, going, "Kla, kla, kla, kla." He turned to the older woman and demanded angrily, "Who were those two that entered here today?" But the woman did not reply. The young people looked at one another. The bearer of the sun put his question angrily 4 times before the woman said to him at last, "It would be well for you not to say too much. 2 young men came hither today seeking their father. You have told me that you pay no visits when you go abroad, and that you have met no woman but me. Whose sons, then, are these?" She pointed to the bundle on the shelf, and the children smiled significantly at one another. The bearer of the sun took the bundle from the shelf, unrolled the 4 robes, the robes of dawn, blue sky, yellow evening light, and darkness, and the boys fell out on the floor. He immediately seized them. Fiercely, he flung them at some great sharp spikes of white shell that stood in the east. The boys tightly clutched their life feathers and bounded back. The man hurled them equally at spikes of turquoise in the south, haliotis in the west, and black rock in the north. The boys always clutched their life feathers tightly and came bounding back. "I wish it were indeed true," said the sun, "that they were my children."
4 symbolical colors, representing the points of the compass, play a prominent role in Navajo iconography and cult. They are white, blue, yellow, and black, signifying respectively east, south, west, and north. These correspond to the red, white, green, and black on the hat of the African trickster divinity Edshu. For the house of the father, like the father himself, symbolizes the center. The twin heroes are tested against the symbols of the 4 directions to discover whether they partake of the faults and limitations of any one of the quarters.
The terrible father essayed then to steam the boys to death in an overheated sweat lodge. They were aided by the winds, who provided a protected retreat within the lodge in which to hide. "Yes, these are my children," said the son when they emerged, but that was only a ruse, for he was still planning to trick them. The final ordeal was a smoking pipe filled with poison. A spiny caterpillar warned the boys and gave them something to put into their mouths. They smoked the pipe without harm, passing it back and forth to one another, till it was finished. They even said it tasted sweet. The son was proud. He was completely satisfied. "Now, my children," he asked, "what is it you want from me? Why do you seek me?" The twin heroes had won the full confidence of the son, their father. The need for great care on the part of the father, admitting to his house only those who have been thoroughly tested, is illustrated by the unhappy exploit of the lad Phaeton, described in a famous tale from the Greeks. Born of a virgin in Ethiopia and taunted by his playmates to search the question of his father, he set off across Persia and India to find the palace of the sun. For his mother had told him that his father was Phoebus, the god who drove the solar chariot. The palace of the sun stood high on lofty columns, bright with glittering gold and bronze that shone like fire. Gleaming ivory crowned the gables above. The double folding doors were radiant with burnished silver, and the workmanship was more beautiful than the materials. Climbing the steep path, Phaeton arrived beneath the roof, and he discovered Phoebus sitting on an emerald throne, surrounded by the hours and the seasons, and by day, month, year, and century. The bold youngster had to halt at the threshold, his mortal eyes unable to bear the light. But the father gently spoke to him across the hall. Why have you come? The father asked. What do you seek, O Phaeton? A son no father need deny. The lad respectfully replied, O my father, if thou grantest me the right to use that name, Phoebus, light of the entire world, grant me a proof, my father, by which all may know me for thy true son. The great god set his glittering crown aside and bade the boy approach. He gathered him into his arms. Then he promised, sealing the promise with a binding oath, that any proof the lad desired would be granted. What Phaeton desired was his father's chariot and the right to drive the winged horses for a day. Such a request, said the father, proves my promise to have been rashly made. He put the boy a little away from him and sought to dissuade him from the demand. In your ignorance, said he, you are asking for more than can be granted even to the gods. Each of the gods may do as he will, and yet none, save myself, has the power to take his place in my chariot of fire. No, not even Zeus. Phoebus reasoned. Phaeton was adamant. Unable to retract the oath, the father delayed as long as time would allow, but was finally forced to conduct his stubborn son to the prodigious chariot, its axle of gold and the pole of gold, its wheels with golden tires and a ring of silver spokes. The yoke was set with chrysolites and jewels. The hours were already leading the four horses from their lofty stalls, breathing fire and filled with ambrosial food. They put upon them the clanking bridles. The great animals pawed at the bars. Phoebus anointed Phaeton's face with an ointment to protect it against the flames, and then placed on his head the radiant crown. The divinity advised,
If at least you can obey your father's warnings, spare the lash and hold tightly to the reins. The horses go fast enough of themselves. And do not follow the straight road directly through the five zones of heaven, but turn off at the fork to the left. The tracks of my wheels you will clearly see. Furthermore, so that the sky and earth may have equal heat, be careful to go neither too high nor too low. For if you go too high, you will burn up the skies, and if you go too low, ignite the earth. In the middle is the safest path. But hurry, while I am speaking, dewy night has reached her goal on the western shore. We are summoned. Behold, the dawn is glowing. Boy, may fortune aid and conduct you better than you can guide yourself. Here, grasp the reins.